Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, the Agriculture Minister John Steenhuisen under increasing and intense pressure over his FMD response. The mother city is ranked the world's worst port. What does that mean for exporters, truckers and the cost of doing business? The June 30 immigration confusion. Is there really a legal deadline for undocumented migrants or is misinformation now taking hold? And more British expats are looking to South Africa for retirement. Is this lifestyle, value for money, or something a whole lot bigger? It's Wednesday, the 17th of June. The Democratic Alliance today wanting John Steenhuisen to be demoted to a deputy minister position and replaced as agriculture minister by Willie Okump. This follows a request by the Democratic Alliance leader Jordan Hill Lewis, and the story is moving quickly and still nothing at this point from the presidency. But beyond the cabinet drama, farmers are still dealing with the real-world consequences, vaccine delays, movement restrictions, export damage and deep frustration over the state's handling of the outbreak. Andrew Morphew speaks for Foot and Mouth Disease Response SA and joins me on the program now. Andrew, a very warm welcome. Obviously, you're aware of what's happening in the political sphere. Does your organization have any immediate reaction to the call for the minister to be removed?
Jeremy, yeah, thanks for having me on. The news obviously came as a shock to us this morning, as I'm sure it has to everyone else. Our immediate response is obviously that it's regrettable that it's come to this. Action needed to be taken. We had highlighted repeatedly that the plan was failing. But to be very clear, from our perspective, this was never about the minister. We have been working on trying to resolve things and put in place a plan that actually works to solve the problem, which is foot and mouth. And that has been our objective, and that will continue to be our objective no matter who is sitting in that seat.
Is it a political crisis or still first and foremost an animal health crisis?
I think it's a mix of a lot of different crises. It's an economic crisis and it's an animal health crisis. And I think for farmers, it's a human crisis. We are seeing that farmers are suffering kind of financially and emotionally. The animal suffering is just horrific. And the economic costs, because as you alluded to, we can't export. There are quarantines. And the direct impact of the economic losses on farm are massive. So it affects us in a number of different ways.
Let's talk about consequence so we can come back to it. But where do you think government has failed most badly in the short term in its response?
The plan is wrong for what they're trying to do. So that is the first point that we're making. And it is just literally they're focusing on the wrong target. They are counting number of doses arriving in the country. They're looking at how many animals have been vaccinated over time, when the target should be population immunity. You need to get all the animals immune at the same time to stop the virus from spreading. And that requires us to vaccinate the entire population in 6 to 8 weeks and repeat that every 6 months, because that is how long a vaccine lasts. So until you get the target of the plan correct, the goals need to be right. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to get there.
Did the court ruling, Andrew, on private vaccination in any way change practical terms for farmers?
I mean, practically, it didn't change anything. I mean, obviously, it made everyone very aware that it was a policy decision which had kept farmers out of the response. And that now needs to be corrected. We are completely in favor of vaccinating under state control. The state has to be involved. It needs to be in charge of the rollout. It is a state controlled disease, but the only way you get to the scale where we are going to vaccinate enough animals to stop the disease is to have all hands on deck and everyone working to vaccinate animals and to stop the spread of the disease.
As we have this conversation, are farmers actually getting vaccines, or do bottlenecks still exist?
No, they're huge bottlenecks. Farmers are battling to get vaccine, and it is a huge crisis. We are seeing vaccinated animals that are being infected now post-vaccination, and that is purely because the animals around them have not yet been vaccinated, and the viral load, the challenge on those animals is still so high that even the vaccine is not preventing those outbreaks. So unless we can fill in all those gaps and do it very quickly, as I say, in a 6 to 8 week period, we need to vaccinate everything so that all the animals reach peak immunity at the same time we starve the virus. Until we can do that, this will perpetuate.
And if we don't reach that deadline that you're referencing?
Well, the consequences are dire. I mean, we will end up fighting this disease and chasing our tail forever. And farmers can't afford that financial cost. I spoke to someone this morning that is going to the bank today to ask for a 5 million rand loan to cover the losses of a foot and mouth outbreak on their dairy farm. And there's a limit to the number of times the bank is going to extend that line of credit to you. So there will be huge economic consequences, job losses, food inflation as a result of this if we don't get on top of it now.
You say to me it was never about the minister, but has government, in other words, the minister, listened properly to farmers, to vets, to industry experts on the ground?
No, and I think that is one of the problems. So from our perspective, certainly, we've tried repeatedly to engage. We have had successful engagement recently in the last week, I would say. But the reports, especially coming out of critical places like where with the ministerial task team, where they have not been given adequate amount of attention. The allegation there is that the minister only ever spent 10 minutes with them on an online platform. And I mean, I can't verify that, but those are the stories you hear coming out. And by that measure, I would say no, they have not been listened to. And the experts and scientists that have been repeatedly calling for a better response, a more organized response, a more scientifically and biologically driven response, do not seem to have been heard.
If there is a new agriculture minister, what should be the first instruction on day one?
Well, that would be my recommendation, is speak to your ministerial task team, speak to the people who have been involved in the response on the ground, understand where the bottlenecks are and remove those. I mean, that is the only way we're going to scale this thing up. We now have vaccine in the country. We've got a lot of vaccine on the way. Vaccine is no longer the constraint. We need to remove the bottlenecks and vaccinate at the speed and scale that this disease requires.
Does FMD Response SA have a preferred candidate?
We don't. We will work with whoever is in the seat, and we look forward to continuing to work with the government in solving this. So whoever is serving as the Minister of Agriculture, we will engage with readily.
Andrew Morphew, thank you very much indeed. He speaks for FMD Response SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Durban may be showing signs of improvement, but Cape Town's port has now become the new symbol of South Africa's logistics crisis for exporters, importers, and freight operators. This is not just an embarrassment, it's a cost, it's a delay, and a competitiveness problem. I want to talk to Gavin Kelly now, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Road Freight Association. Gavin, welcome to you. And how serious is it that Cape Town now ranked the worst container port in the world?
Yeah, it actually is very sad, isn't it? Because it's one of the key ports out of the seven of our ports that operate on a large commercial basis. It is the hub for what everyone knows as the fruit garden of the country. So huge amounts of grapes and citrus, apples and pears, berries going through that port. And that's probably one of its biggest problems, is that it has very, very large quantities of peak cargo is going through. So the port will be a little bit quiet, and then all of a sudden we have harvest coming along, and we have wheats and barleys and fruits going through, etc., etc. And then it also has a weather issue. So it's not in the Cape of Storms, or it's not called the Cape of Storms for no good reason. So it is a bit of a problem, but there's a deeper problem lying here, and that isn't equipment. It's about the actual efficiency of the port itself. It's getting the port and those who work in the port to actually start operating like ports across the world. That's really the secret.
What do you mean by that? How do you measure and improve efficiency then?
Well, there are a couple of things that are done. So, for example, container moves by hour. And I'm sure that your listeners saw a document from the Minister of Transport a couple of weeks ago where she was now saying, oh, we're going to do 25 container moves an hour or whatever the figure was. And where do you get that? Well, you get that from the Rotterdams and the Hamburgs and the Shanghais of the world, San Francisco's, you name it. So that's the first thing, is that you need to move boxes or containers on and off ship at a rate, at a given rate, that will ensure that your cargo moves through the port. The second thing is you've got to make sure that you've got, in actual fact, the hot bodies and the shifts to run. You can't have boats lying, or ships, I suppose, lying alongside in the port for days. They come in, they want to get those boxes on or off as quickly as possible, and they want out. So having lots of ships standing off the port always looks good, but perhaps it isn't, because penalties come into play. And then finally, you really need to manage how you get those boxes or the cargoes in and out of the port. And we struggle with congestion around our port heads all around the country, but specifically in Cape Town.
Are freight companies and that's your constituency, Gavin Kelly, are they being forced then into expensive workarounds to try and hide the true scale of this issue?
Well, Jeremy, how do you hide it? So, or work around it, I suppose, is the first part of your question. Can you go to another port? Is there another port close by? The answer to that is a very definite no. We don't have something like Cape Town, that sort of capacity close to Cape Town. Yes, you've got Gqeberha, PE, up the coast, but that's not just, 15 minutes drive up. You've got other ports around Africa. So what people need to understand is that the customer will decide what ports or what mode of transport I'm going to use. So if I'm exporting grapes, even though perhaps, per example here, the port of Cape Town is 2 or 3 or 4 hours away from where I am, but the port of Walvis Bay is 6 hours away, but I know when my cargo gets there, it's going to be offloaded and out of that port within an hour or whatever the case may be. That's when those sorts of decisions are taken. So you might spend more in fuel and time, but you would spend less than what you're spending trying to get through our port. So that's the first thing that is going to happen. And secondly, any freight company worth its salt is going to look at how they can minimize delays and minimize costs. And they will do anything to keep the customer, whether that's new technology, whether it's finding different modes or different ports.
But the risk of the problem, as I see it, Gavin, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a knock-on effect here. You have the delay in the port. Obviously, that will cause some kind of congestion or delay. It pushes up the freight costs of the companies that you represent. And inevitably, at some point, that is passed on to the consumer, surely.
Oh, absolutely, Jeremy. So when you have a delay in your vehicle stand, any transporter will tell you those wheels have to keep moving, because you have some fixed costs and then you have some operational costs that go along. So fixed costs are the cost of your vehicle, those sorts of things. You've got staff costs, driver costs. You want to keep moving. You want to get those trucks to turn around. We call it sweat the asset as much as possible. So you can't have them standing somewhere. And because there's a fixed cost per day, and any transporter can work out reasonably easily what his truck or her truck costs him or her every day, and that will be priced into the cost of ton per kilometer. And so if those costs start to escalate, you and I, the consumer, will start to pay that.
Government, of course, keeps talking about private sector participation, Gavin. Is it moving fast enough, or are we still stuck in reform, which is not happening?
You know, I'd like to play devil's advocate here and start off by saying no, but one has to acknowledge that there is movement. Obviously, we'd like it to be a lot faster. So you've seen Pier 2, the terminal in the port of Durban that now has a private operator, and there have been some amazing changes, and we will start seeing that bearing fruit as we go along, and hopefully that will be a template for other ports. But definitely we need to move faster on this. Other, you know, one would have thought that our ports would have been chock-a-block with what was happening in the Strait of Hormuz, but it hasn't happened as much as we would have liked it to have happened.
You talk about moving faster. If you were sitting opposite Transnet today, what would you demand then needs to be fixed first in order to get things moving quicker?
Well, it depends on the port, because that's a difficult question. So some of the ports have very bad access routes into them in terms of the roads. The roads are narrow, very windy. There are some obstructions in terms of bridges and what have you. So you would need to be able to fix that so the vehicles can get in and out effortlessly, I suppose is the right term, but pretty easily. However, it's always going to be the movement of the boxes in the port itself. So, for example, you can't move a box seven times before it moves out. And when does that happen? When you move boxes to stacks, and then you've got queues of trucks waiting to get those boxes, and they've got to go look for them. And you've got these cranes running all over the port, straddle cranes or whatever they might be, trying to look for the box of the truck that's standing at the gate, as it would. So you've got to look at the port. You've got to look at its access points. You've got to look at how you store the trucks, or stage the trucks is the term. So do you have them in a long queue, or do you, like, for example, Amsterdam or Rotterdam, bring in a small rail system that takes it to another place where you can have trucks in a parking zone where everyone is first and everyone is last? As the box comes, you deliver it. So those really are the key parts in terms of how quickly you can get something in and out of a port.
Gavin Kelly is the Chief Executive Officer of the Road Freight Association. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The so-called June 30 deadline for undocumented foreign nationals to leave South Africa is sparking fear, anger and confusion. Now, government says it's not an official deadline, but anti-immigration groups are still mobilizing around it. Professor Lauren Landau is with the African Center for Migration and Society at Wits University in Johannesburg. Professor, a very warm welcome. And let me start simply. There is no legal force behind this June 30 deadline. In your opinion, then, why do you think it is gaining so much traction?
This 30th deadline is extraordinarily important. So the government, with the president's speech about 10 days ago, has tried to take the wind out of the sails of these movements, March on March, Dudula, others. But they're never going to do everything that those movements want. Those movements have essentially held the government hostage to say, do what we want or we will take violence to the street. And I suspect, as do, it seems, hundreds of thousands of other people on the ground, that movement is ready to be violent and to expel people on the 30th of June.
Why do you think it's so easy for South Africans to be misled then into thinking that immigration enforcement can be outsourced to communities and these pressure groups that you've referenced?
I think there's a couple things going on. One, we should say that many South Africans also recognize that this is a distraction from the real problems and the real causes of the problems that they face. But I think you've seen over the last decades, and even longer than that, this kind of community policing, of vigilantism on the ground, often using the language of liberation or transformation or community development, is something that's been naturalized, not just about immigration, but about crime enforcement and security more generally. So this kind of mode of operating is not unfamiliar. And then when you see people who are desperate, you see unemployment high, people will look for reasons. And we as a species tend to look inward and say we must protect our own first. So I think all of these circumstances make this very risky. And the fact that the government over the last few years has effectively endorsed these messages mean everyone is believing them and it's ripe for action.
So how difficult then is it to pull back from the brink?
I think politically, the government has put itself in a very difficult situation. From a law enforcement perspective, this wouldn't be hard to undermine. Many of these groups have violated the law. Many of them have used hate speech. They've done things that would allow the government to step in, hold them accountable, if they could get the police to collaborate. However, with an election coming up, that would mean the government going back on one of its core messages, back on one of its platforms, which is saying it's not us causing these problems. Immigration is behind poor service delivery, insecurity, other problems that you face. So the government right now is stuck, but should they choose to act, there are very clear and obvious things that they could do.
But they seem reluctant to do so.
I think it would mean to step forward and say, look, we are going to hold March on March or Dudula or any of these other groups accountable would mean a massive break with practice. Since 2008 and the big attacks we've seen then, there's been very few people who've been prosecuted. If they are, it's people on the ground, not the people organizing these sorts of activities. To go against these groups, which have legitimacy in the areas where they operate, would be to step against now many of the popular attitudes. It would be to alienate many movements. It would be to fragment some of the political structures that they built up. And that's a risk I don't think they're willing to take with an election around the corner.
And June the 30th is just around the corner, Professor. What do you think police then need to do if these private groups try, as they have suggested, to inspect documents, close shops, or simply force people out? And already we're seeing evidence of people booking buses and preparing to leave.
Yeah, I mean, the police need to maintain order, or we should say restore order. What we've seen over the last few weeks is the police often abetting these groups, sometimes cheering them on, sometimes assisting them overtly. What we need is the police to revisit the Constitution, revisit the law, and ensure that they are ensuring that everybody on the ground is indeed safe and that the law is followed, that it is the government doing inspections and that the government is not held ransom by violent vigilantes.
Aside from the government, Professor, is there a sense that other political parties, those in opposition or perhaps even part of the GNU, are exploiting this issue ahead of the election at the end of the year?
I think that's absolutely the case. If we look back to when Herman Mashaba was mayor of Johannesburg, anti-immigration or immigration control became a key part of his platform, of what he did in office. He continues to do that now as a candidate. Many of the other parties, not all, but many, have followed suit, have used this language. There are accusations, which I can't confirm, that there are connections perhaps between Inkatha or the MK party and March on March. There does seem to be some sort of network of groups here who at least are aligned politically and may be in a kind of informal or formal consortium.
Apart from statements of concern, Professor, what can the business community do?
The business community could make even more statements of concern and I think can open backroom deals or backroom conversations with government to say this is ultimately risky and we're seeing it's immediately affected tourism. It's going to affect South African brands around the continent. It's going to affect opportunities to attract investment and workers into South Africa. These are conversations that need to be having with trade and industry, with the sort of foreign aid groups and investment groups. That should be happening behind the scenes. They could help craft a new narrative, a way out of this. But I think business has been reluctant to stand up to the government. They feel vulnerable and unfortunately haven't been making the statements we'd like to hear.
So do we have any sense then, Professor, and this is a last question to you, what the responsible policy answer is? Is it better enforcement, as you've suggested? Do we need to improve documentation? We've spoken in the past about better border enforcement. Or do we need something different, a completely different public conversation around this?
I think we do need a different conversation. Yes, I think we need the workplace inspections that the president has promised. Those are already available in law. We do need a border control that is driven not by profit, but by actually checking for the security of South African citizens and ensuring guns, drugs, etc. are not coming in. What we don't need is just blanket deportations, blanket kind of militarization of the border. That hasn't worked in the US. It hasn't worked in Europe. It's not going to work in South Africa. Rather, we need to step back and say, look, immigration is part of regional development. It's part of regional security. It's not going to go away. It can be a benefit to South Africa, and to think carefully about what we need to do to make sure that South Africa can benefit from people moving throughout the region.
Professor Lauren Landau from the African Center for Migration and Society at Wits University here in Johannesburg. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday. for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa, I read, is increasingly being seen as a retirement haven for British expats, with lifestyle, climate, property, healthcare, and access and cost advantages making the country a lot more attractive to UK retirees. But the financial picture is far more complicated than the postcard version. Cross-border retirement planning brings major tax, inheritance, capital gains, residency and currency issues. And for British retirees with assets in both the UK and South Africa, the big question, I think, is just not where they want to live, but how their wealth is structured before and after they move. Well, someone who has a view on that is Luke Hurst. He joins me now. He's wealth manager at Private Client Holdings. Luke, let's start with the big picture and welcome to you. Why is South Africa becoming more attractive to British retirees right now? I suspect the answer is fairly obvious, but tell us anyway.
And yeah, absolutely. I think you summed up a number of those reasons. You know, there's obviously a sort of change in the global climate and how South Africa is being viewed. I think the cost of living, certainly after sort of those COVID years, has increased in many of those, especially developed countries, like areas like the sort of UK. And I think some people are just looking for a level of adventure. And as we know, we've got the beautiful spaces of Cape Town and the garden route and the food and the wines, but as you rightly said, the medical care here is very good and very first class. And also for people coming, maybe even with the even younger families, we've got very good sort of education sort of options for young families and young children.
Having said that, though, what is the biggest financial mistake then that retirees make when moving to South Africa?
Well, there's a number of things. I think the first thing is to understand what the tax laws are in the country you are leaving and the country you are going to be setting up in, i.e. South Africa. And why that's important is that down the particular sort of line, you need to understand your residency and certainly tax residency of if you're leaving the UK, when you how long you're going to be a tax resident in the UK, and when you come to South Africa, how long is it before you become a tax resident in South Africa? And there's something called double taxation agreements, and the UK and South Africa have those, and it's important that a person making that trip takes the right tax advice to understand when and where, which tax net he or the family are going to be in.
And South Africa, as I understand it, taxes residents on worldwide income. And I would imagine that maybe not enough retirees understand that.
Absolutely. And it's the same really in the sort of UK sense as well on the inheritance tax. But when you're coming to sort of South Africa, there's various presence. There's something called an ordinary resident, and then there's a physical presence test, and each of them are slightly sort of different, so you need to know that sort of technical side of things of when you're becoming a resident and when South Africa, when you're now a South African tax resident, as you correctly said, you are now taxed on all your worldwide particular sort of income.
How significant is the UK inheritance tax change going to play? I understand that it comes into effect early 2027. Walk me through that.
So the UK inheritance tax has changed part of it already in terms it was a domiciled system, and now it's what's called a long-term residence, and there's certain technicalities on that. But from the 6th of April 2027, UK pensions are going to fall into the inheritance tax net for UK tax residents, whereas before they were excluded from inheritance tax. And you know, the first £325,000 in the UK is inheritance tax free. Then over that, you pay a 40% inheritance tax. Now, if you start taking a house and you start taking some cash savings and some unit trusts, and now your pension comes into that, what it's going to see is that there's going to be an increase in the number of people who are going to start being paying significant inheritance tax.
So, Luke, should British retirees then be moving assets out of the UK before rules change?
So there's two things in terms of you're getting the tax advice, but you need to also engage with a wealth management firm who have that sort of tax advice as part of their sort of portfolio. Because then you can go through the general sort of analysis, and there's different ways you can do that. So I've had a number of particular sort of cases where you've got cash in the UK, clients have moved over to South Africa, they are now South African tax residents, but their cash is still in a UK bank account. It would be far better to move that outside onto an offshore particular sort of platform, so that money is building for you, but it's also outside of the UK net.
And what about fixed assets? What happens, for instance, if a retiree owns property in the UK but lives permanently in this country?
So in the UK, a lot of people keep UK assets and houses in particular. And what is happening with those is obviously you're getting rental and you get UK tax on that particular rental. If you're a South African tax resident, then in your South African tax return, you have to show that UK tax rental as well. But there is a double taxation agreement between the UK and South Africa. In terms of when you come to sell that property, there's capital gains tax in the UK. And again, being an SA tax resident, capital gains tax in South Africa. In terms of the UK, they have certain... if you've been renting out your property for a non-resident, if you have a valuation from the 6th of April 2015, you can use that as a valuation for your UK capital gains tax for when you sell it today. But from South Africa, South Africa will have a different calculation. And it's why it's really important that you get UK and South African tax advice on what portion of tax you're paying in each country so that you can make the right decision.
Luke Hurst, Wealth Manager, Private Client Holdings, thank you very much indeed. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.